events outside of the Gospels, which confirm that the testimony of the Gospels is reliable. And I've been saying historically reliable. You say, why do you have to throw that historical in there? Because as we talked about last week, the Christian faith is rooted in a historical series of events. Unlike other religions, which may be based on philosophies or systems and thoughts and ideas, the scriptures have those. But ultimately, if the Christian faith is rooted in this reality, that God became flesh, dwelt among us for a period of 30 plus years, that he walked among men, he died, was buried, and raised from the dead, and the Bible even tells us when these things happened. And we can go to sources outside of Scripture, as we will do tonight, and find that the testimony of the Gospels is, in fact, a reliable testimony. So I could have done a PowerPoint, but this will give you something that you can take away with you. And I kind of hate to give everybody what we're going to be talking about, because then you know where I'm going, but I'm just going to have to live with that reality. So before we begin, there is a very small but very loud minority in our time who argue that Jesus never even existed. Is there anybody in this room who's encountered these people? All right, well, I've had some discussions with them, and I know someone, one of you brought it up, them up to me some time ago earlier in our sessions. They have put out a fair amount of literature. They get a fair amount of press. There are debates out there with these people. And you'll run into them from time to time if you're putting yourself out there very much. But I just want to say here at the outset that that position has no ancient antecedents, which is to say nobody took that position until the very late 1700s, when we had two authors who were in France during the French Revolution saying, hey, you know, this Jesus of Nazareth guy, he never actually existed. For 17 plus centuries, everyone, friend and foe alike, who'd mentioned Jesus had operated on the assumption that he really had existed. Now, since the 1790s, it's been out there. And I'll mention one work, just if you're interested in history. There was a German who published a book in 1909 he called The Christ Myth, and it's probably the most influential of any book along those lines that's ever been written, because a man by the name of Lenin read that book, and he believed it. And the man who started the Soviet Union pressed that idea, and it may surprise some of you, it did me, to learn that for decades, this was a predominant view, a very common view in the Soviet Union. Behind the Iron Curtain, a common idea was Jesus never even existed. And in parts of Scandinavia and in Europe today, this is a dominant position. So we're over here on the other side of the pond, and these voices are loud in certain circles, and maybe most of us here are not affected by them. Apparently we're not, but it is out there. But it's a very small minority in most of the world, and the reason is there's too much evidence to the contrary. So that's what we've got here in the first two pages. We have non-Christian ancient authors who mentioned Jesus. Let's just take up the first one. First one is from a man named Tacitus. Cornelius Tacitus is his full name. He was a Roman historian. He's extremely highly regarded, whether you're a Christian or not. You can go to the Oxford Companion to Classical Literature, and it says this of Tacitus, that his annals, the part of one of his books that we're going to be quoting from in particular, show him to have been one of the greatest of historians. This man was born around A.D. 55, A.D. 66. He lived through the reigns of six emperors. I won't bore you with all this information about him. But what we're going to be quoting from was written about 115 A.D., so early second century. John the Apostle has not long been dead. Tacitus references Jesus twice and Christianity twice. Or pardon me, Jesus just once. And the most important is this one we're going to read. So let's read it. Consequently, and by the way, the context for this, 64 A.D., there had been a July 64 A.D., there had been a very terrible fire in Rome, and it laid much of the city waste. And I know we're familiar with this, many of us. Who was believed to have started that fire? Nero, the Caesar. Yes, those of you who said Christians were right too. The populace thought Nero had done it, and he may well have done it, because it allowed him to kind of clean things out and rebuild it in his own image, which he enjoyed doing. But Nero's a politician. Even though he's an emperor, he still wants the people on his side. So he has to find a scapegoat, and he chose the Christians.
So let's read this. Consequently, Tacitus writes, to get rid of the report that he was the one guilty, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, that's the Latin for Christ, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilatus. And a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for a moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty. Then upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much of the crime of firing the city as of hatred against mankind. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burned to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired. You know, these are brethren we're reading about. Animal skins were put on them and they were thrown to the dogs. They were covered with pitch and lit on fire and used to light Nero's gardens. They were crucified. And what we want to notice at the moment, though, is that here's this Roman. What's he think of Christianity? Oh, it's evil. These people are guilty of abominations. And notice, by the way, what does he say there? That they were eventually, many of them were convicted, but not so much for setting the city on fire, but for what? Hating mankind. Does that sound familiar? There's nothing new under the sun. If you tell people that what they identify as is not right, you're a hater. If you say that not everything is okay and certain things are true and certain things aren't, you're a hater. This is a very, very old idea. And Christians, almost from the beginning, have been fighting or having to deal with it. There's a lot we could draw from this, but we just want to notice that Tacitus, this Latin Roman author who does not like Christians, speaks of them. Their name came from Christus. Jesus was this Christ. He was killed by Pontius Pilate, who was one of our procurators down in Judea. And notice, by the way, what he also says, that after Jesus was killed, the superstition, as he calls it, was checked for a moment. It stopped it for a moment, but then after a while, it broke out again. Does that sound like something we read? Jesus is crucified, but then what happens 50 days later? Pentecost comes and Christianity explodes. It's just kind of cool. This fits exactly with what the Gospels and Acts bear out. Let's go to the next quote. This one from Suetonius. His full name is Gaius Suetonius Tranquillus. We don't know very much about this man. He was chief secretary for Emperor Hadrian between 117 and 138 AD. He wrote some biographies called Lives, and in one of them, which we're quoting from right now, there's a possible reference to Jesus. Let's just read it. It's concerning a wave of riots which had broken out in a Jewish community in Rome in AD 49. He writes, as the Jews were making constant disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, he, that's Claudius, expelled them from Rome. Now, we say a possible reference to Christ because just looking at this, why might this not be a reference to Christ? What are some possible reasons? I mean, we got a riot in Rome and it's among the Jews and it's at the instigation of this fellow named Crestus. So you say, well, Jesus really wasn't ever in Rome. He certainly wasn't there in AD 49. So true. But Suetonius is writing this much later. And there were a lot of problems, the scriptures tell us, among Jewish communities throughout the Roman Empire in the first century. And what was the problem? Christians. So it could be that Crestus is a possible misspelling. Even Bart Ehrman the atheist says this is a common misspelling. There's a lot of E's and I's being shifted around in the early centuries. So I don't know that this is a reference to Jesus, but it's a possible one. Something that's of interest, however, notice he says that Claudius, the Roman emperor, expelled the Jews from Rome. Does that sound familiar? Sure. Acts chapter 18, verse 2, Paul met Aquila, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded the Jews to depart from Rome. In his life of Claudius, Tacitus also, or Suetonius also mentions that during Claudius's reign there were, quote, constant unfruitful seasons. And remember how Agabus had said there would be a great famine in the days that came to pass in the days of Claudius Caesar. Let's go to the next one. Josephus. We know about Josephus. He was born just a few years after Jesus was crucified. He was a Pharisee by the age of 19. He was born into an aristocratic priestly family, so he held a position of prominence and wealth in his community. AD 66, the Jews revolt against Rome and they try to throw off the Roman yoke, and Josephus is put in charge of the Galilean forces. Well, the Romans come to squelch the rebellion, and they've got to go through Galilee to get to the heart of the rebellion. And Josephus' forces don't fare very well. In fact, he and 39 other men find themselves in a cave, and rather than surrender to the Romans, they decide, well, we're all going to kill ourselves. And they make this suicide pact. But as they're drawing straws or casting lots, somehow, either by luck or design, Josephus ends up managing to being one of the last two. So 38 men die, and then it's just Josephus and the other guy, and Josephus convinces him, hey, let's not kill ourselves. Let's go turn ourselves in to the Romans. So they do that. And the man who is besieging the city of Jerusalem at the time is not Titus, who will eventually take it, but his father, Vespasian. And Josephus is, he's slick. He says to Vespasian, you know, I've had a prophecy. And God has revealed to me that you are going to become the next Caesar. Well, I don't, you know, that was a roll of the dice. It ended up working out in Josephus's favor. Nero kills himself. Three men for a short period of time vie for the throne. And then finally, Vespasian's armies declare him emperor. He goes off to Rome to become the emperor. And Titus stays behind, uses Josephus as an interpreter. And after they take the city, Titus takes Josephus back to Rome. Josephus becomes part of the family, takes on the name Flavius, becomes a pensioner and a historian. And he writes a whole bunch of stuff at court expense. He mentions Augustus, Tiberius, Claudius, Nero, the Herods, all in the Bible. He mentions Quirinius, who's mentioned in Luke 3:1. He mentions Pilate, Felix, Festus. He mentions the high priestly families, Annas, Caiaphas, Ananias. He mentions the Pharisees and the Sadducees. He mentions the Judas that Gamaliel talked about. He mentions John the Baptist. He mentions Herod Agrippa's death by worms, which, by the way, how have you envisioned that? I won't ask for the gory details. But when My vision had always been that Herod died and then was eaten by worms. But that's not what it says. Acts 12 says he was eaten of worms and died. And when Josephus tells us the details, and Josephus isn't trying to corroborate Acts, he just tells us that he had these internal worms and they gradually ate him over time. And then he died. So it fits the biblical narrative. Well, Josephus has a famous quote here, a couple of them, one which mentions Jesus' brother. It's the first one. I don't know how much of the background you want to know, but Festus is dead, and there is a new procurator on his way, Albinus, but he hasn't arrived yet. And so the high priest, wanting to exercise some power, steps into the vacuum that's temporarily available, and he kills James, and it appears some other brethren. And that's what Josephus is telling us about in this first quote. He, Ananus, the high priest, assembled the Sanhedrin of judges and brought before them the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, whose name was James, and some others, or some of his companions. When he had formed an accusation against them as breakers of the law, he delivered them to be stoned. So here's Josephus saying, yes, there was this man named Jesus, he was called Christ, and he's got this brother James who was stoned. This happened about 62 AD. Now for the next quote. The next quote's the most famous one, and let's just read it. Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him. For he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold, these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him, and the tribe of Christians so named from him are not extinct at this day. So if you had this quote and this quote only, you were told there's this fellow named Josephus, he's writing this somewhere around 95 AD, this is before Tacitus and Suetonius, first century Jew, and he writes this about Jesus. If this was all you knew about Josephus, what would you assume about Josephus? He's a believer. He's a Christian. But Irenaeus tells us in the early second century, no, he was not. And there's nothing in Josephus' writings elsewhere to suggest that he was. So it does make you wonder if this is original. Here's the deal, though. The manuscript evidence for this is very good. It's written in the style of Josephus. Eusebius, writing in the early 300s, quotes this, and he's got everything that we have here. So if this was added to, it was done very early. But you can imagine that there's a lot of people who doubt it, and I myself look at it and I think, really, did Josephus write that? So we have a 10th century manuscript that's in Arabic, and it reads a little different, and it's the second quote I have there, or the last one at the bottom of the page. So let's read it. At this time, there was a wise man who was called Jesus. His conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous. And many people from among the Jews and the other nations became his disciples. Pilate condemned him to be crucified and to die, but those who had become his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he had appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion, and that he was alive. Accordingly, he was perhaps the Messiah, concerning whom the prophets have recounted wonders. Maybe that's the more authentic quote. One way or the other, Josephus, all the textual evidence, all the hard evidence says, Josephus mentions Jesus, and he mentions him twice. So for those who are saying Jesus was not a first century figure, there's no basis for that. There's a lot more we could say about Josephus, but let's move on. We're not going to go through all of these because we got to get to other stuff, but Pliny the Younger was in the second century. He was a Roman administrator over Bithynia. We have 10 books of letters of his. I know a brother, I won't mention his name, who told me a couple years ago that he was reading through all of these. That takes some dedication. But his 10th book of letters is what he's best known for, because it's there that he's writing to Trajan, the Roman emperor. So here he is, he's a governor of this province, and he's having a problem. Rome has made a law. Now this is interesting, I think. Early 2nd century A.D., the Roman government has made a law that no social groups, social gatherings are allowed. Now, what exactly prompted this law in the beginning, I don't know. But they're so serious about it that even fire brigades, they're not in existence. So that when the communities get set on fire, they don't even have people to take care of it. The Roman government, for some reason at that time, did not want people gathering in groups. Now, I'm sure families were probably accepted, but sounds familiar. I'm not trying to make a point here, except that people have dealt with this sort of thing before, and the Christians were still gathering. And so he writes to Trajan, he says, okay, there's this group of people who are meeting, they're called Christians, and here's what he says about them. They were in the habit of meeting on a certain fixed day before it was light, when they sang in alternate verses a hymn to Christ as to a God. Notice he just assumes. We all know who Christ is. Trajan knew who he is. I know who he is. We know he's a man. They treat him as if he's a God. And they bound themselves by a solemn oath not to any wicked deeds, but never to commit any fraud, theft, or adultery, never to falsify their word, nor deny a trust when they should be called upon to deliver it. After which it was their custom to separate and then reassemble to partake of food, but food of an ordinary and innocent kind. They're not gathering to be cannibals, as some thought they were. It's just ordinary food. I don't know if this is the Lord's Supper or the love feast or what, but this is what these early Christians were doing in this region. It's interesting that we don't have time for all of this, but he tells Trajan that what I've been doing is I've been bringing them in. You know, they're breaking the law. They're getting together. You said you don't want these groups happening. I'm bringing them in and I'm questioning them. And if they're willing to offer up incense or adoration to your idol, then I let them go. But if they won't and they're not Roman citizens, I'm executing them. And if they are Roman citizens, I'm sending them on to you. Is this the right way to handle this? And Trajan writes him back and says, you're handling it right. You're handling it right. Now, don't go looking for these people, but if they come into your circle, what you're doing is the right thing to do. And he makes the remark in the letter that a Christian, it is said at least, cannot be induced to curse Christ, even if it's going to cost him his life. And it's a powerful thing. The next quote, and then I think we may move on,
is by a man named Lucian of Samosata. This man was a satirist in the second century. In other words, he made his living by making fun of people. Do we have those people today? We do. He made his living by making fun of people. And he's written a number of things, and he talks about Christians and so forth. In this, it's called his Death of Peregrine. He writes the following. The Christians, you know, now remember, he's making fun of them. The Christians, you know, worship a man to this day, the distinguished personage who introduced their novel rites and was crucified on the account. You see, these misguided creatures start with the general conviction that they are immortal for all time, which explains the contempt of death and voluntary self-devotion, which are so common among them. And then it was impressed upon them by their original lawgiver that they are all brothers from the moment that they are converted. And they deny the gods of Greece and worship the crucified sage and live after his laws. All this they take quite on faith, with the result that they despise all worldly goods alike, regarding them merely as common property. So once again, yeah, there's this man they follow. He was crucified. He taught things. They're following. He doesn't mention Jesus by name, but he's clearly talking about Jesus. I will leave the other quotes with you. We're going to move on. But these are historians. And in the last two, you've got Christians who are quoting non-Christians. Because some of these works, like the man Phlegon there we have at the end, we don't actually have his writings, but we have Christians quoting them. And it's interesting. These are Greek or Roman writers who are saying that in regions outside of Palestine, earthquakes and the sun was going out at the time that the Gospels tell us about the sun going out for those 3 hours. So it appears, possibly, that those earthquakes weren't just taking place in Palestine. It wasn't just dark in Palestine. It was maybe dark the world around, which would fit. Any comments or questions on this before we move on to the next stuff? Now, this next stuff may look terribly boring to you. I think this is really interesting. So bear with me while I explain what we've got here. In 2002, we're on page 3 of the naming patterns. In 2002, an Israeli scholar by the name of Tal Elan, you know, some people, I-L-A-N, by the way, you know, some people like details. Tal Elan apparently really likes details. She went through the writings of Josephus, the text of the New Testament, documents from the Judean desert. She went through documents found at Masada. She went through early rabbinic writings. She went through ossuary inscriptions, which I'll explain what ossuaries are in a moment. Just notice they're limestone boxes. She went through all of these, and what she did was she compiled a list, a lexicon, a dictionary, of all the recorded names that the Jews used in Palestine between BC, 330 BC and 200 AD. So for a period of 500 years, she gathers all these names. And most of the material came from 50 BC to AD 135. All right, 50 BC to AD 135, right when the Gospels are taking place. Her book comes in at 510 pages. It weighs over 2 pounds. And last I checked, you can buy it for the bargain sum of $218 at Amazon in case you were looking for some affordable and relaxing bedtime reading. I don't intend to look into this book, but I really enjoyed a British scholar who went through her book and compiled the data to discover patterns. And this is where it gets really interesting. Richard Baucom is what his name is, went through all her collected data. He found that over that period of time, there were 2,953 occurrences of names, and there were 521 names, okay? But then he went through it and said, okay, what were the most popular names according to all these Palestinian Jewish sources? Palestinian meaning right in that region where they were all living in the first century, the Jews were. What were the most popular names among the Jews at that time? The 6 most popular names among Jewish men in Palestine in the first century were Simon or Simeon. Those are versions of the same name. Same with Joseph and Joseph. And this is the order. Lazarus, Judas, John, and Jesus. Do those names look familiar? Yeah. The 6 most common female names were Mary, Salome, Shalomzion, Martha, Joanna, and Sapphira. Joanna and Sapphira were tied. So just from
from the get-go, you're like, well, you know, that sounds like the people I encounter in the Bible who were supposedly recorded at the same period of time. Now, here's where it starts getting really interesting. If you look at the naming patterns among Jews in other parts of the empire at the same time, they're totally different. If you go to the Jews in Rome, they're hardly even using Aramaic names. They're using Greek and Roman names. If you go to Libya, if you go to Turkey, their naming patterns are totally different. So here's, for example, I've got the third group there. What are the most common Jewish names in Egypt at the time? Eleazar, Sabbatias, Joseph, Dositheus, Pappus, Ptolemaeus. So, if you are somebody who does not live in Palestine in the first century among the Jews, let's say you live over in some other part of the empire, it's 100 AD, and you've decided, I'm going to write a story. I'm going to write a story about Jesus, and it's not true. I'm fictionalizing this, but I'm going to try to pass it off as real. How likely is it that you're going to know the naming patterns of those in Palestine at that time? I mean, how many of us here have ever opened up a book or a magazine article or something and said, the most common names in 2020, and then you look at them and you're like, I had no idea these were the most common names. And that's in your own time and place. So there are many, there are people who try to argue that the Gospels are not first century documents or they were not written by eyewitnesses as Matthew and John, we claim they are. But how would you get the naming patterns right? And let's go further to the second section. Baucom went further into the data. Among the Palestinian Jewish sources, 16% of Jewish men had the name Simon or Joseph, which were the two most popular names. If you look at the Gospels and Acts, 18% of the men had the name Simon or Joseph. In Palestinian Jewish sources, 42% of the men had one of the nine most popular names. In the Gospels and Acts, 40% of the men had one of the nine most popular names. Palestinian Jewish sources, 8% of men had a name no one else had. In the Gospels and Acts, 4% of men had a name no one else had. Why is this lining up like this? This is the sort of thing I could expect to find in actual eyewitness, real, reliable, true testimony. Not what I would expect to find from, as one guy put it, invented fabrications written at some hazy distance from the events in a different location. But let's go a little farther. 50%, about half of Palestinian Jews in the first century went by about 12 different names. So the Jews were not being very creative with their naming in the first century. And there were reasons for that. We don't need to talk about those right now. But so about 50% of the population, based on the data we have, was going by about 12 different names. So you can imagine being in that situation. You might know 12 different Marys. Somebody says, well, I was talking to Mary, and of course the question is, Mary who? So how are you going to know which Mary, which Simon you're talking about? Well, going through this information, Baucom said there's about 11 different ways the Jews would add things and manipulate the names so they would know which Mary, which Simon, which Joseph they were talking about. For example, they would add to the person's name the name of his or her father. I go to Luke chapter 3, verse 2. I read of John, one of those common names, the son of Zacharias. They would add to their name the name of another family member. Well, I go to John 19, 25. I read of Mary, the wife of Clopas. They would add the name of one's profession, like Simon a Tanner. They would add the place of origin, like Joseph of Arimathea. They would even add a name from a different language. We know him often as Mark, but what name did he also go by? John Mark. John is a Hebrew name, Yochanan. Mark is a Latin name, Marcus. But this was very common at the time. We read of Saul, who is also called Paul. He didn't undergo a name change. Shaul, Saul, was his Hebrew name. Paulos was his Greek name. This was very common. In other words, the patterns that were found in all this data are right here in the Gospels and Acts. Dig a little bit deeper. What was the most common male name among the Jews in Palestine? Simon, all right? So, if it's the most common name, I should expect to find a lot, when Simons are mentioned in the Gospels, I should expect to find Simon with something else so I know which Simon it is. Well, in the Bible, the Gospels and Acts, I read of Simon Peter, Simon the Canaanite, Simon the Zealot, Simon the Leper, Simon a Cyrenian, Simon a Tanner. Mary was the most common female name. Well, I read of Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, Mary the wife of Clopas, Mary the mother of John. But to really make the point, look at the bottom. In Matthew chapter 10, Matthew, this Jew in Palestine, lists for us the names of the 12 apostles. And look at his list. The number is the popularity of the name. With the sole exception of Andrew, who's identified as Peter's brother, Matthew adds what he's called disambiguators. He only adds them when the name is among the 11 most common names. But with Philip, Bartholomew, Thomas, Thaddeus, these names that were uncommon, there's no disambiguator. Because those names were unique enough that you didn't need one. Matthew's showing us how they thought of names and how they used them in the first century. If I were trying to concoct a story, I could not have pulled that off. By far the simplest explanation is that the gospel authors were able to give an authentic pattern of names in their narrative because they were reliably reporting what people were actually called. And given that names are also hard to remember, the authentic pattern of names in the gospels suggests that their testimony is of high quality. After all, if you can remember the hard stuff, the names, you're going to remember the stuff that's easier, stories. Now, of course, as believers, we look at this and we go, well, I know these men wrote as they were moved by the Holy Spirit. But if I'm on the outside and I'm trying to see if this is reliable stuff, this kind of information, although it's detailed and it's down in the weeds, it's compelling. Comments or questions before we go to the final three pages? All right, well, let's look at some of the archaeological finds. These are just a few. There's a bazillion of these. You know, we're not looking at the Pool of Bethesda, the Pool of Siloam, on and on and on. Tomb of Herod the Great, which was found in 2007, on and on and on. But we're just going to look at a few. These top two are some inscriptions related to Herod the Great. I call this an amphora fragment. Does anybody know what an amphora is? I learned what an amphora is today. You've seen pictures of them. The Greeks and the Romans used them. There are these tall vases. They're kind of thin, and they've got the two handles. They would use them for wine. That's an amphora. And what you have here are some fragments from an amphora that was found at Masada. Masada was a fort that Herod the Great had built a palace at. And on this is written the Latin inscription, belonging to Herod, king of Judea. Now, if we were to look at the rest of the inscription, we would discover the date and the type of wine that Herod was having imported from Europe. That's what was going on. So apparently he had a wine jug. It's a wine from this time, wine from this place. But it belonged to Herod, king of Judea. Now here you and I are, and we're like, well, okay. I mean, the Bible tells me about these people. Yeah, but there's plenty of people who've said, well, your Bible could say all that it wants. I need some evidence outside of the Bible. And here we have some. To the right, we have one of many coins that have been found in the region of Israel from Herod the Great's reign. This is from 37 BC when Herod the Great's reign began. On the left, on one side of the coin, you can see is a helmet. He conquered Jerusalem with the help of the Romans in AD 37. So this is probably commemorating his victory. And on the right, you can see the Greek characters which go around that tripod in the middle. And the Greek inscription reads, of King Herod. And this is one of many. So just hard evidence. Yeah. We've got the testimony. We had Josephus. We had others talking about him. But here's actual archaeological evidence that he did, in fact, exist. And by the way, I mean, his existence, there's no one contesting Herod's existence. They found his tomb in 2007. All these discoveries, this is a done deal. Yes, what the Bible was telling us, insofar as this man's existence, is absolutely accurate. The next inscription was found in Caesarea. Back in 1961. Prior to 1961, we had lots of ancient references to Pilate, but we had no hard physical archaeological evidence of his existence. They were looking at the amphitheater that's there, and in the staircase, They found this stone. It used to be somewhere else. The ancients would do this. They would reuse stones. You tear this building down, you take the stone from here, and you build something else with that stone. And they'd use this stone from a previous structure. And it's got several lines. We can only read part of three of them. I've got there on the bottom what it looks like in English characters. So, you know, I've had time to look at this for a while, and I realize some of this stuff might take a little time to kind of process. But when you're looking at Latin letters, just remember that the V's are actually U's. That's how they made their V. It was U. And when the T's are written, the top of the T is usually put up above. At least in this inscription is. It's put up above the other letters. So what we can read is Tiberium Pontius Pilatus, prefect of Judea. So here was hard, fast evidence. Oh, yeah. And this was found in Caesarea. What was the capital of Judea? Where did Felix live? Where did Festus live? Where did Pilate come from when he went down to Jerusalem? Caesarea. So, all right, this fits what we have in Scripture. Let's go on to the next one. Lysanias is mentioned in Luke chapter 3, verse 1. He's Lysanias the Tetrarch. After Herod the Great died, his region was broken up into four sections. Lysanias was one of the men who reigned over that. Prior to this inscription being found in Damascus, we had no references to Lysanias except in the book of Luke. And you can imagine how the detractors treated that. Well, you know, Luke's talking about him, but where's the evidence? Well, we found this inscription near Damascus, which isn't far from Abilene, which he ruled over. And without going through the whole description, that little push section I put the box around, it reads, of Lysanias, the Tetrarch. And we know it's the same Lysanias because it mentions two august lords up earlier, and there was only one time in history, a 15-year period, from 14 AD to 29 AD, where there were two august lords in the Roman Empire, and it was when Tiberius and his mother were both wearing the title Augustus. So it's a 15-year window in which this inscription falls, and that fits perfectly with Luke chapter 3, verse 1. The next one is an ossuary. I know some of you know what ossuaries are, I'm sure, but an ossuary from about the 2nd century BC to 70 AD, when Jerusalem fell to the Romans, the Jews had a practice. They would put the body in a tomb, just as the Bible tells us they did with Jesus. They would come back about a year later after all the flesh had decayed. They would gather up the bones, and they would put the bones in a limestone box called an ossuary. We have found over 10,000 of these. Only about 100 of them have inscriptions, and we're going to look at three of them that have an inscription. The first one here is labeled, the man was named was Jehohanan. He's not a biblical figure, but he had undergone something we read about in Scripture. In this ossuary were found the bones of a man in his 20s, and he had been crucified. And the nails were still in his hand, in his wrist, and in his foot, in his heel bone. And you can see there on the right, they've got a replica showing what it would have looked like at the time it happened. And to the right is the heel bone with the 7-inch Roman iron spike in the heel, which, you know, it appears what they did was they would put the heels together, and they would shift the guy's legs to the right or left, and then drive the nail through. And then we have Caiaphas. Caiaphas, of course, was the high priest during the first century when Jesus was crucified. Caiaphas is the one who wanted him dead. This ossuary was found. What is the year? I'm not remembering off the top of my head right now. Back in 1990, you'll see the inscription on it reads, Joseph, son of Caiaphas. You're like, oh, well, this is a son of the high priest. Well, Josephus tells us that Caiaphas was actually named Joseph, and he was also called Caiaphas. He says it twice. The quotes are very brief in Antiquities. He writes, Joseph Caiaphas, and then later writes, Joseph, who was called Caiaphas. So Caiaphas was a family name. It would appear to be derived from an individual in the family. And it's thought by many this would be his bone box. The bones in this ossuary were of a family, because they would put more in it after the original. But one of the bones was of a 60-year-old man. And that would fit. And Some people argue that that might not be his ossuary simply because it does not list him as the high priest. And fair enough. But notice how nice it is. Look at Yohanan's. Look at this one on the last page of James. These are very simple boxes. This Caiaphas, whoever he was, Joseph Caiaphas, he's got an awful nice ossuary. So it sure fits. It's in the right time period. It's in the right style. It fits that it would be him. But this last one's the best of all. October 2002, Oded, that's his first name. I can't remember his last name. A Jewish antiquities dealer and a collector revealed he had bought this ossuary from an antiquities dealer, if I remember right, back in the 1970s, but he had not noticed what was written on it. Well, eventually he did, and it came out that the bone box, the ossuary of James, the brother of Jesus, had been found. So in 2004, 2 years later, and I'm almost done, the Israeli Antiquities Authority, they have that, because you can imagine why they would have that in their country, and the state of Israel, they brought a lawsuit against this man. They said, No. What you have here, yes, James, son of Joseph, is legitimate, but the last part of the inscription, brother of Jesus, it's a forgery. That's been added. So they went to court. Let me briefly read to you. 5 years of court proceedings, 116 hearings involving 138 witnesses, 52 expert witnesses, 400 exhibits, more than 12,000 pages of court transcripts. And in March of 2012, Jerusalem District Court Judge Aharon Farkash cleared the defendants of all forgery charges. All the experts, all of it, they put this thing through the ringer. There is no reason not to believe that this is legitimate, that this is the real deal. So it's fascinating. Statisticians who like to crunch the numbers, there's a 95% chance that in Jerusalem at that time, there would have only been 1.71 men named James with a brother of Jesus and a father of Joseph. So we got two guys to choose from. Well, 1.71 guys to choose from. So it's kind of fascinating to think that Jesus' brother James, this may be the very box in which he was buried. And it's interesting. Tradition said that he had been buried in the Kidron, near the Kidron Valley, that he had been stoned, and then about a year later, his bones had been put into an ossuary. And the antiquities dealer, the original antiquities dealer who had this, said it had been found in the Kidron Valley. So it fits. And so, you know, the case for the Gospels is cumulative. No one little piece of evidence is enough to seal the deal. But when you take it all, and we've not begun to touch it all, but when you take it all, where does the preponderance of the evidence lead? What's the simplest explanation that requires the fewest assumptions? So this is real history. It really went down. And you stand on solid ground.